Howdy. How you doing? Good. Good to hear it. Boy, I must say, feel very inadequate to give the sermon today. But after what I heard, you know, from Mr. Anderson and others, because that, you know, is a sermon in itself, that's exactly the topic I have to talk about today. But, as any sermon, you have to look to God to provide the inspiration. And I think, you know, that the topics that you hear today are probably all woven together by Him and, inspired by Him. So with that, I want to start into what I wanted to talk about today, because a few weeks ago I started a topic about a vision of the kingdom of God and capturing a vision of the kingdom. Because without that vision, you know, we tend to perish, or we tend to throw off restraint, or we tend to kind of just fall back into the old patterns and habits of the world. And so a key thing for us to be able to attain the kingdom is to capture a vision in our minds. And one of the key things that we learned last time, which I won't turn to, but if you remember in Colossians 1:13, it says that He's delivered us from the power of darkness and conveyed, or He's transferred us into the kingdom of the Son of His love. And last time we learned that there's literally two kingdoms. That there's the kingdom of this world that's ruled by Satan, and there's the kingdom of God. And God, when He calls us, has literally plucked us up from the one kingdom and put us under the rule of the other kingdom. This is a literal transference of under the rule of another kingdom. We're under the rule of another commander. And that also means, and it carries all the ramifications of not being subject to all the things of the other kingdom, and that those are things that we can claim. So we learn this, and we also learn that this other kingdom will always try to pull us back into its world or its way or its rule and make us subject to it. You know, and God says that we are no longer have to be subject to the pulls or the death grip that that has on our lives. You know, a lot of times that comes in ways of sins or things that just plague us and just continually pull us back into that. So we also learn that, you know, that is something that we're learning, is that we're learning the process that God takes us through. Because when we're set up to rule, it's not like we're just biting our tongue today and then someday, you know, when I get a hold of those people, I'm going to really show them how it is. The only way that will work is the way that God works with us today, and that is through His grace and His love. And when you get to the kingdom, we're not going to all of a sudden be on a throne zapping people. And so the process that we go through today is to learn that, because that's how we will interact with the people of this world. And so Christ came and He preached this gospel. When it says that Christ came preaching the gospel of the kingdom, it was a new thing, and it encompassed all of these concepts that we're talking about here. Concepts of being transferred into a new kingdom, the power of that kingdom, all the things that encompass that kingdom. Now, for the second part of this series of sermons, which I can imagine will probably end up going on forever, I want to talk about an aspect of capturing that vision. And specifically, the part I want to talk about today is the preparation of the kingdom of God that happens in this lifetime. Specifically, I want to talk about the part that trials play in the process, the part that trials have in a Christian's life, because once you're transferred into this new kingdom, a process is started. A process starts in your life that's different than everybody else's life in this world. It's something new, and it's something different, and there is a purpose and a methodical reason why it happens. It is not just a haphazard thing, but there is direction and purpose to it. Now, it's important to understand those things, because that's part of the vision of that kingdom that helps us to make it through this life and operate through these things that we end up going through. So today I want to take a deeper look at these trials, and I want to put them in the context of the kingdom. And let's start to get it into our mindset how that can become part of that vision that we have for this kingdom. You know, what are these trials for? You hear, you know, a lot of different things. Are these trials punishment? Right? And I think if you talk to anybody who's going through a trial, they'll admit that they have sins and they have done things wrong and continue to do things wrong. But I think they'll also tell you that they know there's something deeper to it than just a punishment. There's something more than just, I did something wrong, God's getting me back for it. I think that anybody who's going through a trial can tell you, you know, yes, I admit and I know that I need to put things out, but there is something much deeper in this process. So I think it's safe to say it's not about punishment. It's not about God getting you back. Because if God got us back for what we deserve, we would be dead. It's just plain and simple. And God doesn't operate that way. God actually wants us to learn from our heart the way that He gives to us. You know, is it so that we can comfort other people, you know, as Mr. Anderson was saying? I think that's an important part. I also think that's an important part, you know, in this lifetime. You know, was I given a son with disabilities so that I can comfort, you know, other people with disabilities? Potentially, yes, and in this life. But I also read in the book that in the world tomorrow that there's going to be healing offered up, that a lot of those problems won't be there anymore, right? So, yes, that's a very important thing to understand and to do in this life, and God does, you know, allow people to go through things to help others in this lifetime. But I also see a time where there will be great healing in the future as well. I think we'll also see that there is a lot much deeper meanings that, you know, as Mr. Anderson was saying, he practically gave this entire sermon in his, you know, 5-minute talk there. There's a lot of depth to what he was saying, and you can see the experience in his life of what he's been through, he and his wife. You can hear that coming out. That is something that you can't just have in your head as head knowledge, right? You can only have that in your head after going through trials that are very deep and very long and very difficult. That is something that is spoken from the heart. And I think when we get into the trials and understand them, we'll see there is a much deeper meaning to them. There is something much more to them. So with that, let's get into a couple examples. I want to take a few examples in a few scriptures today. The first one I want to start with is King David. So this is something that we had covered in our Bible reading program. So I'd like to reiterate some of the pieces that we went through. Let's turn back to 1 Samuel 20, verse 1, and kind of set this up. Because there's some very interesting examples. This is when God was working in David's life. God's hand was in all of these events that happened here. 1 Samuel 20 and verse 1. This is kind of the key phrase, right? This is a key phrase when Saul was after David, wanted to kill him. David said, you know, he fled from Naoth in Ramah and went and said to Jonathan, you know, what have I done? What is my sin? And what is my sin before your father that he seeks my life? You know, why is he chasing me? Why is this happening to me? Is basically, you can see the kind of anguish that starts at the beginning of a trial. There's kind of an anguish, like, what did I do to deserve this? Or why is this happening? And David reiterated the same thing. What have I done against your father? I have done nothing against him. You know, why is he seeking my life? And from there, he launched into a series of things that you'll see in chapter 21. He fled, and that was the case of the showbread. Doeg the Edomite ratted out on him, right, and, you know, told Saul. Then he had to end up fleeing to Gath. Chapter 22, all the malcontents gathered around David, you know, all the kind of outcast of the world and those that were discontent gathered around David. Saul ends up murdering the priests. Chapter 23, we have a story of betrayal that starts to take place. David saves an entire city. He does something noble that he didn't have to do, and he asks God, you know, if it push came to shove, is this city going to actually turn me into Saul? He said, yes, they'll turn you in, right? And you can imagine the kind of bittersweet betrayal feeling that that kind of brought up too, because he just went and saved the city that he didn't have to do. And then in chapter 24, we know the famous story where he saved Saul's life for the first time. Chapter 26, he does it again, the same thing. He shows his noble character. 27, he ends up having to ally himself with enemies. And in chapter 29, you know, his enemies end up rejecting him. You know, this story kind of goes on and on and on, and this is difficulty, wall after wall, intense trials, intense emotions that happen, betrayals, things that are strong, things that are weak. There's just an intense amount of time that's happening during this period. You know, what would you be thinking at this time? You know, this is not a very glamorous start to being a king, is it? He knew he was going to be king, but this is not glamorous. Right, and this is, you know, approximately a time period of around 10 years that this took place, that David was fleeing and running for his life. Now, in all of this, David was wronged. In other words, Saul was not chasing him justly. He was chasing him unjustly, and David did not lift his finger. You know, could you end up taking wrong for 10 solid years that way? At what point would you break and try and solve it or take it into your own hands? And I think we see something very important here, right? Because we see something, that a process that was happening. So, you know, what was this 10 years of fleeing in the wilderness all about then? Right, what was all of this about? Because it just seems like, well, it's getting off to a rocky start. Was it a bunch of sin involved? Was it a bunch of other things involved? I think what you see is you see something developed in David during this time. And why is that? Because David was to become a king. right? And becoming a king requires special qualities that are not for the average person, are they? Being a king requires qualities that to lead people in a godly manner requires these godly qualities, right? And those things are things like patience, like we were talking about before. What if the people underneath you want to rebel or don't want to listen to you or want to do something against you? Do you have the quality to not just react to that immediately? Do you have the quality to not just kind of, okay, since you have the power to say, you know, put away those people, you could even put them to death if you wanted to. What if they spoke against God or you as the king or something like that? What is your first reaction going to be? So I think we start to understand and kind of synthesize out of this that these special qualities of becoming a king are what was being built in this time period. Right, this intense amount of pressure and time was developing certain traits that were not for the average person. The average person wasn't going through the same thing that David was going through, were they? Some people were along for the ride, but a lot of these were focused on David. And David was tried and tried again. The opportunity to take it into his own hands was put before him a couple of times because Saul was right there in the cave. And his men were talking in his ear saying, look, God's delivered him. God's doing this. God is in this. Look, God has put him in your hands. Go ahead and kill him. And David, time and time again, had the opportunity to take it into his own hands. He had to be tested and tried and strengthened in those qualities. Why? Because he had to before he reigned. This is before he reigned. Now, we look in the Bible at a lot of different cases, and you'll see that being trained like this, this concept in the wilderness, happened to a lot of God's people. You know, David was 10 years. You know, Paul was in the, you know, wilderness being trained for at least 3.5 years or so. Moses, 40 years. 40 years out in the wilderness. This is away from Egypt, away from all the trappings of life, out in the middle of nowhere, being trained. When he came out of it, he ended up stuttering. He wasn't of great speech. Right? Jacob, he fled into the desert. He was out working for Laban. He was continually tricked and duped, like he tricked and duped his brother, you know, and his father. John the Baptist was out in the wilderness. Christ was in the wilderness for 40 days being tried, you know, and tested by Satan. All of the people above ended up coming through it. There's a group that was in the wilderness 40 years that didn't end up coming through it. Right? And who was that? Ancient Israel. They were taken through the exact same process. They did not succeed in it. It was not a successful training for them. And we find the reasons in the New Testament why, and I'm not going to get into that. Now, apply this to our lives, and I don't mean this just as a cute analogy, but the concept is the same. What are some of these long, drawn-out trials that we end up going through? Right? What are some of these things? I think what we find is these are the modern-day equivalent of us being taken and put into a wilderness somewhere. You know, because when you're in those places, a lot of times you can end up being very alone. You can, you know, end up being very, wow, it's going to be a... I guess there's a lot of pent-up emotions that you end up with. You know, in these times, you know, talk to people. They're not easy. Please forgive me. I guess there's a lot, you know, of emotions that still hang on, you know, that kind of come back up. But, you know, when these men came through this, it's not like you end up being a Superman. You know, you don't come out, you know, super confident or like Jean-Luc Picard, you know, type of a person, you know, make it so, you know, some kind of Shakespearean actor's voice. Right, these are hard, lonely periods of time. The time that David was, you know, going through the wilderness was not easy. The time that others spend in the wilderness is not easy. And you hear the same thing from others in this congregation. Well, the period of time that we go through, though, yeah, we don't come out as supermen. You don't have a super confident handshake. You're not like out all of a sudden this vital person that's a superhuman. In fact, it's very humbling. But you know, in that humility, there's a strength, but that strength does not come from you. Right, and you find that in David's life, that the things that he was going to have to encounter, and yes, he stumbled, but the things that he was going to have to encounter in his life, he had to rely on God for. You know, not his own. And like I said, when Moses got finished, he was stuttering. It was a very humbling experience. You know, it was something that, you know, wasn't necessarily what the world would view as desirable, or as the person, you know, they wouldn't view you as something that's, they would hold you up on a pedestal and say, you know, this is a great person. This is a super strong man. But you know, that was the start of it. Those people having those periods of time in the wilderness, in us having those same periods of time of, you know, loneliness, intense pressure, intense hardship, are a training. Where are we going? The part of the vision of where we're going in the kingdom is that you and I are going to be kings as well. What applied to David applies to us. It's no different. Before you rule, you have to have the same godly qualities forged in you. That's part of this process. To rule in a godly manner, you have to have those godly characteristics. Just as David was taken 10 years, you see that happening in our lives. So a lot of what we have, you know, we look at it as an immediate trial, but I'd like to rename it a bit and maybe call it a training. Instead of a trial, it's a training, and it's a training to build those godly, kingly qualities in you so that when you come to rule in the world tomorrow, your immediate reaction is not to zap the person in front of you who is maybe despising you. Your immediate reaction is to understand the way God works in a person's life and show mercy and show grace and show kindness. And you hear that in people's voices who have been through trials. Mr. Anderson spoke, and you can hear the grace, and you can hear the wanting to help other people. That is not forged in your head only. That is forged in your heart. That is forged by these times and these periods that we have. You know, do you have an ongoing, continuous, draining trial that you're going through in your life? And I think a lot of us do that happens. Right? That is a unique, handcrafted learning experience or training experience to develop those qualities in you. Right, so that's one of the first things I think we see. I think we have these training periods of what we would equivalently call our time in the wilderness, our years in the wilderness. You know, and I, not that our, you know, my trial has been anything, you know, more than anybody else's, but, you know, there's been periods of, you know, I could count 8.5 years or so where life didn't seem like it was a normal thing for us. You know, it seemed like life was pretty much for everyone else, going out, doing anything normal. You know, and it can be a very, you know, lonely type of a place. And I think a lot of people end up going through that. But I don't want this to also sound negative, because I have a lot of other points in here, you know, that show the flip sides of these things as well. But that's a start at the training period. Let's go on to the second example to understand. Let's look at Job briefly. I'm not going to go through the entire book of Job, but I want to take just a few major points out of here. Specifically, I want to take 3 points out of the book of Job. Let's turn to Job 1, verse 1, and understand a few things. Job 1 and verse 1. And one of the important things to understand is found in this very first verse. Job 1 and verse 1, it says, "There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, and one who feared God and shunned evil." And so what we start out with is that we find that Job was trying on, you know, the best that he knew to obey God. This wasn't a person who's out, you know, trying to sow their wild oats or something. This person, God calls him righteous and blameless. This wasn't his own words. Right? This is what God says about him. and that this trial came on that person. And what we see in verse 6 through 12 is an interesting story if we continue on. It says, "Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. And the Lord said to Satan, 'From where do you come?' So Satan answered the Lord and said, 'You know, from going to and fro on the earth and from walking back and forth on it.' And the Lord said to Satan, 'Have you considered or set your heart on my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, and blameless and upright and one who fears God and shuns evil?'" These are God's words again. That's what God is saying about him. "So Satan answered the Lord and said, 'You know, does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge about him, you know, around his household and around that all he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands and his possessions and have increased the land. But now stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face.' You know, and the Lord said, 'Go and do it, but don't, you know, touch his person.'" Now let's stop and think about this for a second, because it's an important story to understand. You know, this time and chance happened to Christians. Is our life in what happens in there a random event? And I think that we start to see part of the answer from this story is that these events, before they happened, were known by God and were allowed by God. And as Mr. Anderson said, the same thing. We know that God's allowing this in our lives for a reason at this time. And that's what this story starts to tell us. These are not random. These are not random events. You know, Christ said that, you know, Satan asked for Peter to sift him. There's a spiritual dimension that's part of this, and that we see that God has complete foreknowledge. God could say, yes, I will allow that, or no, I won't allow that to happen in that person's life. Couple that with a scripture in the New Testament, Romans 8:28. I'll just quote it for you, because we all know this. It says, "We know that all things work together for the good to those who love God, to those who are called according to his purpose." This is you. These are people called into the church. It is saying that all things work together for the good of those who love God. This is taking the randomness out of it. You either believe the scripture or you don't. There's no kind of middle ground that happens here. This is saying that all these events and things that are happening in your life are for good, and there's a purpose in them. There is a reason in them, that there is a purpose in them. This is not an idle statement. So the way I would like to phrase it, and this is maybe just the way I phrase it, but I don't think there's just random events in our lives, Christians' lives, like that. I think that they're before something happens to us, that God has the ability to block it or to allow it. And I think sometimes he says, look, this is part of this person's training, and I'm going to forge something in this person, and he allows it. So I truly don't believe that there's just a time and a chance that randomly happens to us like that. I believe God's hand is involved in every step of your life. Like he says, he knows the number of hairs on your head. He knows when a bird falls. Why are we less than a bird? God knows every single step of our lives, and I think that we need to start to believe that, put that in our minds, because that is a clear statement. And I think that, you know, that helps us to understand that it's not a random thing. So let's go back to the story of Job. Job, continuing on, you know, we get to verse 13. Basically, all the things that, you know, Satan did, he ended up taking all that Job had away from him, and his sons and daughters and everyone ended up dying. Now, we come to another important point here, right, after all these things happen, is we see how other people tend to react towards us when we end up going through a trial, don't we? And what we see here is Job's three friends. So Job's three friends came to comfort him. What a little bit of comforting they did, right? They ended up, you know, pretty much rubbing bitter salt in the wounds for this man who was under this intense suffering. Well, what we find is we have three friends coming to view the situation. And you know what? Think about this. This is how we naturally as human beings or carnally tend to view somebody going through a trial. Let's hear what God has to say about the matter in this book, because that's an important point to get out of this. First, we find Eliphaz the Temanite. You know, if you turn to Job 4, 6 through 8, this would kind of sum up his arguments. Each one of them presented some sort of an argument to Job why he's going through this. That's what's kind of written verbosely in this book. Job 4, verse 6 through 8 says, you know, "Is not your reverence your confidence, and the integrity of your ways your hope?" It says, "Remember now, whoever perished being innocent, right? Or where were the upright ever cut off? Even as I have seen, those who plow iniquity and sow trouble reap the same." So what was his argument? What was the gist of it? You know, you're pretty much sowing what you reap, Job, right? Somewhere you've done something, so you now deserve this, was his basic argument. So if you ever hear somebody saying that to you, say, oh, thank you very much, Eliphaz the Temanite. So just use it, and they'll probably look at you and back away. But At least you'll know what you're talking about. So the next friend to come along was, you know, Bildad the Shuhite. And, you know, this guy was not very big at all. All right, that's a really bad joke. His shoe height, never mind, okay. Okay, so Job 8, verse 4 kind of sums up his argument. You know, Bildad the Shuhite came and presented, you know, here's why you're going through it. It says, if your sons have sinned against him, he has cast them away for their transgression. He's saying, well, guess what? Your sons and daughters deserve what they got because somewhere they sinned. Is this kind of a reoccurring theme going on here, right? And verse 5 through 6, it says, you know, if you would just earnestly seek God and make your supplication to him, if you were pure and upright, surely he would awake for you and prosper you. Like if you didn't have some sin that you were hiding, God would prosper you in this. You know, what did God say about him to start with, right? That goes in opposite. Now, let's look at the argument of the last person. Zophar, the Naamathite in Job 11. Job 11. Job 11 and verse 13 through 15. You know, his other friend came along and said, you know, if you would just prepare your heart and stretch out your hands towards him, if iniquity were in your hand and you put it far away, right? Every one of his three friends has some variation of the same theme. Job, you know, there's just some sin that you have done that is causing this. Right? And when you read through these ramblings of these men, don't they sound like arguments that you have heard and you have used? I know I have, right, when talking to people, and I've thought them, maybe even thought them in my mind. It's very important to understand something, though, right? What does God say about those statements? In the end, he says that God was very mad at those men because they misrepresented him. That was not an accurate representation of what was going on, is what he was saying. Right? Because let's go to the end, Job 42, and see how this is summed up, because this is some very important lessons to understand, and let's kind of pick out three main things here. Job 42 and 1 through 10 we'll read. So at the end, you know, God went through a discourse with Job, and then he said, Job answered back and said, you know, Job answered the Lord and said, I know that you can do everything and that no purpose of yours can be withheld from you. You asked, who is this who hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore I have uttered what I did not understand. Things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. Listen, please, and let me speak. You have said, I will question you. You shall answer me. And I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Okay, there's a pivotal statement. That was a change that happened here. That's a difference. And I want to come back to that statement because he says, you know, I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Therefore, I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes. If God says he was a righteous man, what is he repenting of? Right? God, he was repenting because he saw himself as a human being and what he's capable of. Even if he didn't necessarily do a sin, he saw the sin that was in him. He saw himself compared to God, to Christ, to what God does. And when you do that and compare that properly, the only thing you can say is, I repent. If you don't say that, then you don't get the lesson of it. So it wasn't as if he was out doing something. This is a deep understanding of your own nature and who you are compared to God. Not compared to the person next to you, but compared to God. Job came to a deep understanding. That's where he said, I repent. You know, some people like to summarize this as, you know, Job was just self-righteous. I don't think that's an accurate representation of what was going on here, because I'd like to explain that a little bit better. And so verse 7 it says, and so it was after the Lord had spoken these words to Job that the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, my wrath is aroused against you and your two friends. You have not spoken of me what is right as my servant Job has. Right. So those words they were speaking, God all of a sudden says, you know, I am angry with you now because of that. You know, take seven bulls and go to my servant and offer them up, and Job shall pray for you, and for I will accept him, lest I deal with you according to your folly. These are foolish words God is saying to them, because you have not spoken of me what is right as my servant Job has. That, to me, sounds like a very... He repeated the same thing twice. I think that there is an important lesson to understand that there, right? And so what happened is they went and offered bulls, and it said at the end, you know, the Lord restored Job's losses when he prayed for his friends, and he gave them twice as much. So what are the three things? In this end thing, there's some really important things to understand out here. One is when we see someone going through a trial, it's carnal for us to think that they're being punished for some sin, whether it's open sin that we've seen them do or a hidden sin that we know they surely have. Because that's what Job's three friends said. And God was very displeased with that. He's very displeased. Right? If you find yourself saying that to people in trials, please don't. Right? Consider yourself on the same shaky ground as Job's three friends if you say that. God is displeased with that because he's not happy with that. Right? You cannot know what God is building or doing in that person. And misrepresenting God because, you know, humanly we want to just say something or vent it out to somebody is not an idle thing that God just likes to kind of put away. He said, and we understand from this book, that that is pretty serious to God when you misrepresent him to somebody going through a trial like that. Right? So think very carefully. Right? Pray for wisdom if it doesn't come naturally to people in a trial and what to say or what not to say. Right, and if you find yourself thinking, well, you know, I don't have any big trials, so I must not have some secret sin, that's a variation of the theme of the same kind of thinking. It's just internal to your mind. You know, if that's what you think, you see other people with trials and you think, well, I must be doing things correctly. My advice, this may sound funny, is I would actually go to God and ask him for a trial. I would, because there is an incredible thing that you learn during trials. There's an incredible thing that you can't learn by head knowledge. Right, so that's one of the important lessons. That's a carnal reaction, and we should treat ourselves on the same ground when we react and talk to people that way, or even think about it. Let's try to get those thoughts, you know, in our minds that way. Another lesson is, out of this, you can see that God was forging the same kingly qualities that he was doing, like in the training with David. So God was forging kingly qualities in Job. What is a kingly quality here? Again, these three friends pretty much, you know, said bitter words to him. And what was his reaction? Well, you know what? He didn't quite have that under control or learned yet, and that's part of the process here, is he did end up reacting to them, right? He did end up getting kind of embittered over it, right? That because his friend just kept rubbing it in. Now, one of the things that he was teaching him here is to have that kingly quality and not to have that kind of reaction, because you see at the end that God actually restored things after he prayed. Like, not only did they do wrong to him, but God wanted to see it develop that he would actually pray for them, even though they despised him. This is what Christ did. When Christ was being crucified, he said, please forgive them. This isn't just some, oh, I've got to wrap things up nicely and say that. He meant that from the heart. Stephen said the same thing when he was being stoned. Please forgive them. Those are from the heart because he understood the process and what the kingly qualities are. So that, you see that same kingly quality and characteristics of what it takes to be a king, because Job's going to be a king, and it takes those qualities to be a king. Again, you see that happen again. What's the third one? Third lesson. A very important thing to understand out of this, that sometimes these things and lessons are not just ingrained in our head just by our thinking or our intellect. Right? A lot of times you hear things and you can agree with them and you may think that they're great, but sometimes our heart has to be involved for you to really learn something. Your heart has to be involved. You know, the deep emotions that come through trials start to burn and etch a lesson on you and in your heart that somebody's not going to take away from you, are they? I can have it in my head and I can know it forward and backward as was said in the sermonette in my head. But until my heart knows that and knows that I know that, you know, somebody could snatch that away or events could change and it could become different. So when we submit ourselves to the process of trials, that gets etched on our heart so deeply, and his way of life is solidified, sealed. It's not just head knowledge, it's part of your being now. That's something that somebody can't take away from you. Job said, I've heard of you by the hearing of the ear. You know, I knew all these things. I've heard them all my life. I've been in your church all my life. I've done them all my life. I know what to do. In fact, I'm doing them. I am righteous, as God said. But now my eye sees you. All of a sudden, the depth of how he knew God was different. It was on a much deeper, emotionally engraved and carved in his heart level that you don't get just by head knowledge and hearing. These trials sometimes have to happen for that. You know, when deception comes someday, those that know their God won't give up the truth easily at all. So what part of this trial is, you know, if somebody comes with you with arguments and deceptions, and you have it ingrained in your heart so that you know your God, It doesn't matter what they demonstrate to you, some great miracle, some healing somebody, some words. They can't take away that from your heart because you know it. So part of this process of the trial is etching that deeply, emotionally on your heart so you know God. And that when that deception comes, you know, it's kind of a deception proofing, isn't it? Right? It's something that somebody cannot snatch out of you. So you get to know God personally. So one of the things to think about and do during these trials is really get to know your God personally. Really get to know Him in that time in the wilderness. And let the process etch it deeply in your heart, because that won't disappear from you. That won't just kind of, you know, vanish someday. Now, there's an important flip side to all this, because, you know, a lot of this can sound, you know, heavy, and it's not. If you ask a person in a trial, yes, it's very difficult, but there's also a joy that can happen at the same time, right? And I'm not trying to just smooth over things, but there is a real joy that can happen. And part of that is that God will offer us relief when we ask Him. God will offer relief. And let me explain that, because let's turn to Psalm 31, verse 7 through 8, and notice a statement here. And this is an important part of a trial to understand, because God can give you a space to breathe. Have you ever been so overwhelmed? You know, you can't breathe. You emotionally can't move. You're locked up. There's just a lot of things that can happen. Well, part of the process is that God can put you in a place where you get some relief. Psalm 31, verse 7 through 8 phrases it this way. It says, I will be glad and rejoice in your mercy, for you have considered my trouble. Right? You've considered my trial. You have known my soul in adversities. You know me. And you have not shut me up in the hand of the enemy, or you haven't given me over to the enemy. You have set my feet in a wide place. I love that statement. You've set my feet in a wide place. You know, what is a wide place? You know, a place that's not wide could be confined or constricted. I kind of tend to think of like a wide open field, wide open green meadow, right? You know, you're in your car, you're at work, you're doing all these things. You may feel very claustrophobic in life. You can get out into the wide open space. All of a sudden, you can breathe. You start to relax. All of that is connoted in this phrase here. God has set my feet in a wide place. He set me in a place that, you know, I can now have a little bit of relief or relax. Psalm 18:17 says the same thing. Psalm 18, if you turn back there, verse 17, says it again. For he has delivered me from my strong enemy, from those who had hated me, for they were too strong for me. This is talking of spiritual warfare, isn't it? They're too strong for me. They confronted me in the day of calamity. This is Psalm 18, verse 17, now verse 18. But the Lord was my support. He also brought me out into a broad place. Same kind of wording there. And I won't turn there, but if you jot down Psalm 118, verse 5, it says the same thing. I called on the Lord in distress, and the Lord answered me and set me in a broad place, in a wide place. I like that phrase. I like it. Because sometimes that's where you need to be put during your trials. And you know, how does that wide place come? How does it come? You know, it may come just, if you've ever been in an intense trial, God may give you a day where things all of a sudden go well, and you say, oh, you know what? I know that God is there with me. Right? And He gives you a break. And you know He gave you a break. It could come in the form of a day. It could come in the form of a whole period of time. Maybe it's a tense amount of years, but then He gives you a break. Like I said, I think, you know, for 8.5 years, I didn't feel like I was participating in life. I felt like life wasn't for us. But you know what? Over the past year and a half, God has set us in a wide place that we were never at before. You know, we've actually gone on dates. You know, there's just things that people think are normal that, you know, weren't normal parts of life. And there's a wide place. There's a break in the problems that were happening. Now, how many of you have been in a trial that when you ask for relief and help, ended up going further and farther than you wanted it to go or thought? I know I have. I mean, you don't have to raise your hand. But, you know, sometimes, let me just put another part of this. When you ask God to put you in a wide place, you can't really predict or don't fix in your mind exactly how and when that's going to happen. Like, I think that's an important part to understand. Will He put you in a wide place? Yes, He will. Anybody who's in a trial can answer that question with yes, and they will tell you. But if you try and figure out exactly when and how it is, I think that you end up, you know, you end up butting your head and maybe get, you know, in despair at some times. Like I can remember three years ago at the feast, you know, we went through a particularly very hard time. Our son ended up with pancreatitis in the hospital, you know, close to death. And they ended up taking him off his existing seizure medication, because he's on medication to control seizures that he has had. And they put him on a new seizure medication. That started right at the beginning of when I ended up taking off a month from work, and then we had the feast during that time. And I can tell you that was probably the worst month of our entire lives. In fact, that was the worst feast. And I'm not trying to sound negative. I remember being at the feast, because what happens, it's hard to understand, but some of these medications can be quite strong. This particular one, it's not his fault, made my son act pretty much like a wild animal. There was no controlling him. If you said do something, he would do the opposite. If you turn your head, he would be going aggressively at somebody. It made him really aggressive and angry and just kind of all the time. We ended up with just kicking, screaming matches over nothing. You know, I was driving a big truck down the middle of a crowded freeway, and I turned the blinker on and off. Well, that was to set him off. Things like that. So that he ended up, you know, ended up kicking me as I was driving, and just, you know, it just ended up being this like really dangerous situation. Well, this was just a constant thing that happened every day, all day for an entire month. And it's just this incredible amount of stress. And then we were at the feast, and the thing at the feast was, you know, that feast, I just wanted to hear a sermon. You know, some people have a hard time sitting through a church service, but I just wanted to be able to sit through a church service. That was all I was asking for. I remember praying at the feast, you know, can I please hear a sermon? And that one day, all of a sudden, he just calmed down and sat on my lap the entire service without moving. That had not happened. I had not been able to sit in church. In fact, for a couple of years, not really been able to sit in church. But that one sermon I got to hear, and the sermon itself was about encouragement. And the man who was giving it even had an example of, you know, something that my son had done. You know, where he encouraged someone else in his own little way. And I just remember that feast being a very difficult time. You know, I think I practically almost gave up that feast. And I couldn't understand why, you know, at the Feast of All Times, you know, why wouldn't it work out? And I didn't understand that, but you know, I got two wide places. God let me hear a sermon and then a half of a sermon by sitting in the hallway and I could hear it. And you know, that recharged me temporarily, and I went through the feast and I couldn't say I had a good feast. You know, and I prayed for God to put me in a wide place, and there were small ones during. But you know what? What was quite amazing is after that time, changing that medicine, we ended up going through six more medicines before we found the medicine that calmed him down. That's where he is today. Like, I didn't quite understand that at the time. But he set us in a wide place with him, you know, through that process. You know, and on top of it, you know, it was a hard feast, but after that, you know, a month later or so, an opportunity came up to go speak at a thing in the Bahamas. It was an hour talk, and I got to stay there 4 days at this hotel that's like a $400 hotel, and I brought my wife and Cameron. You know, and my work paid for that. And that was a wide place where we got to just, you know, reconnect. You know, kind of re-heal. So when I say, you know, ask God for a wide place, but you may not know how it comes, or don't try and fix how it comes, He will put you there. There's times during it He will, and there's times afterwards. I can tell you now, we're in a wide place with Him. I didn't say we're out of the woods, but boy, we actually can make forward progress in life. For 8.5 years, we barely got our heads above water. So if you're in the same place that I described, pray to God and ask Him to set you in a wide place. Ask Him that, and He will. Ask anybody who's been through a trial. He will set you there. It may come in a different way than you think, right? It may come in a different way, but it will come. And He promises that to us. Right, so let me skip over some of these things and just kind of bring it to a conclusion, because let's just turn to two more scriptures, James 1, verse 2 through 4. And let's just basically look at our reaction to some of these trials and how we react. James 1, verse 2 through 4 says, "My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. But let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing." You know, patience is at work, and patience is the thing that brings us to perfection. That is not something you stick in your head as head knowledge. That only happens over time. That only happens with some of these intense things that we end up going through. Let it have its perfect work. Like, it wouldn't say let it have its perfect work if there was some way that you as a person could resist it. Because there is. There's ways that we can resist that. Right? What is one of the biggest ways? And let me just give you one point in this, not a bunch. But one of the biggest things that, you know, think about anger. You know, becoming angry and embittered at what has happened to you is pretty much an opposite of patience, wouldn't you agree? You know, being patient. I think one of the biggest things that we can do is to start to put away anger in all of its forms, right? That's anger, that's, you know, frustration at it, bitterness, you know, passive internal anger. I'm not yelling at people, but you're just walking around biting your lip, right? And just kind of stoically standing there. That's kind of a form of anger as well. All of these forms are actually the opposite of patience. It says let it have its perfect work because it's basically saying submit to this process. You may not like it and you may be kicking and screaming, you know, as you go through it, but you have to let it have its process and its perfect work. And if you drop down to verse 19 through 20 of the same chapter, it says this. "So, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath, for the wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God." Those anger and those things do not produce what He is trying to work in you. It's a hard thing and probably easy for me to say at this time, but it's one of the most things to look at going through a trial is to put away all those forms of anger and let that patience have its perfect work. That's one of the pieces of, you know, advice I would give. You know, so where does that leave us? And, you know, does that leave you just kind of a weakened person according to this world? What position does that put you in when you're in a weakened state, when you're in a trial, when you've had to learn to rely on God, when you're letting patience have its perfect work and you know that you cannot do anything without the help of God that these trials teach you? Where does that leave you? Where does that leave us in this lifetime? The world may not think it's a great thing, but let me tell you where that leaves us. That leaves us in exactly the place you need to be to be able to do great works by the power of the kingdom in this lifetime. I'm not talking about someday. I'm talking about right now. Doing great works by the power of the kingdom of God, because when you get to that point, when you understand what I've just told you there about relying on God and all of those things, then the power of God works in us. How do you think the great acts of the Bible were done? Were these done by men out of their own power? Were these men, you know, charismatic? Were they talented? Do they have charisma? Is that how they achieve these works? If a man stutters, but he brought out a whole people out of Israel, that's by the power of God. All the great acts you see in the Bible are done by people who were trained under this process and let patience have its perfect work, and by the power of the kingdom of God, did these great works. Right? It was not on their own. And let's read the final verse, because this kind of ties it together. Daniel 11, verse 32 to 33. The works that David did with Goliath, Jonathan and his armor bearer, these were all done by the power of God. Only will these works be done when someone learns this process that I was just talking about through the trials. So yes, this is for the training of being a king, but there is an application that we're going to come upon that's going to become very important for the people who've learned this process. We find that here, Daniel 11:32. Those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery. But the people who know their God shall be strong. What did Job say after his trial? I've heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. I know you. That is what that is saying. Only those who know their God, only those who have gone through that intense amount of pressure and have it etched in their heart emotionally and know their God will be strong against the deception, against what is to come, and they will carry out great exploits. That statement is not idle. That statement is the root of how you carry out those great exploits. Right? You have to get to know God that way. And in this lifetime, in the end time that we live in, there are going to be great exploits that are done. Only if it's done by the power of God's kingdom. Those who know their God will be the ones who are strong and will carry out those great exploits. So there is an application that we have today that actually has greater meaning than just your individual trial. That deception proofing and the great exploits that come at this end time. So let's start to reframe or to look at these, you know, trials and capture and put that into our vision of the kingdom. And if you didn't hear the first part, you know, go back and hear that part, because these work together. But let's accept the many years of training in the wilderness, the kingly qualities that are being built in us to rule. Let's really get to know our God in a deep and an emotional way and totally rely on Him. So no one can take that from you. And in this lifetime, when you learn that, you will carry out great exploits by the power of the kingdom.